Coming up on Boston Public Radio. Okay, so they're keeping records of our phone calls and our emails. But watching us while we watch TV? Not possible, right? Then why does Congressman Michael Capuano want to stop it? He'll join us. Jesse McCord Lewis was one of 20 kids and 6 educators killed in Newtown 6 months ago today. His mother, Scarlett, and head of the Jesse Lewis Choose Love Foundation, she'll join us.
Then Emily Rooney and her famous Emily's List of Gripes joins us at 1. Then, you're not going to believe this one, 2 parking spaces just sold in the Back Bay for, well, stay tuned and find out. Then our news quiz is going to be a bake-off spectacular. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7. Jim Brady, I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Was I missed yesterday?
Yes, we missed you very much.
I don't think so. Okay, so the government is keeping records of our phone calls and of our emails. Actually, but in a recent Pew Research Center poll, a majority of Americans appear to find that acceptable. But watching us while we watch TV, that's not possible, right? Then why have 2 congressmen filed legislation to stop it? In fact, why don't we ask one of them? Joining us on the phone from Boston and Somerville is Congressman Michael Capuano. Welcome back, Congressman.
Hey, Jim. Hi, Maj. How
are
you doing?
Hi. Great to talk to you, Congressman. So please explain to us the aptly named We Are Watching You Act.
I stumbled across something a little while ago, several months ago, that led me to find a patent application for a set-top device, the typical cable box type of device, that would have added features to it that would be able to see you, hear you, use thermal imaging on you and anyone else in the room, and to do all kinds of other 3D imaging and be able to determine what you were doing, whether you were in a good mood or a bad mood. This is a direct quote out of the patent application. They would even know if you were cuddling with someone.
And by the way, when you say the cuddling thing, we read the story in the Globe this morning, Congressman. If this video or whatever it is saw that you were cuddling, all of a sudden an ad for Viagra might pop on the screen. Is that not correct?
That's what they describe it as potential dating services or contraceptive services. And again, that's directly out of the patent application. I didn't make this up. I didn't create the word. The cuddling proposal comes directly out of the official patent application filed by one of the largest companies in the world.
Well, that's the important. I'm glad you said that, because I was going to say this is not some marginal person somewhere in Omaha. These are the Verizons and some of the big companies that are in the cable or the video business that want to watch us while we're watching them, right?
Well, they obviously, and I don't blame them. I mean, technology is interesting, and they're trying to target their ads better, which I get. But and that's why this proposal does not prohibit them from doing it. But all this proposal does is it requires the consumer to know it and the consumer to be able to opt out. If you want your cable company or your television or your phone company or whoever else to be in your home watching you 24 hours a day, even when the set is off, you are entitled to do that. And that's perfectly fine with me. I would think that's a little weird, but that's me.
Yeah. Well, it does seem a little weird, though. Maybe in your old age when you're by yourself in your little apartment, it could be sort of company for you. But Congressman Capuano, I was stunned when I read this story. It's possible then, I mean, I don't know if the patent went into this kind of detail, that Verizon could have done this unbeknownst to Verizon customers.
Well, it's possible. I don't know that the technology is there. By the way, this particular patent has been rejected, which on its face sounds good, except if you think about it, patents get rejected because the technology already exists. And therefore, the technology is out there, is capable of being disseminated, and no one has yet said we will not use that technology.
Well, also, let's make the connection. For those who are smiling at this story, as the two of us are, you expressed, I believe the word was outrage, when you found out about this National Security Agency monitoring here. It is not, let's just take Verizon, I don't mean to pick on them. Let's assume Verizon got the patent, and let's assume the NSA goes to the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
You are correct.
Secretly, and says, by the way, the other thing we want is we want all that video and mood surveillance stuff that Verizon and others are doing. like 1,788 out of 1,789 applications. It'll be granted by FISA. And theoretically, the United States government out in Utah can be watching us while we're watching TV, right?
Absolutely. And the thing that's amazing, because I had the same reaction any person would have when I stumbled across this. It's like, this can't be true. This has to be the beginning of a joke. Where's the punchline? Or this is science fiction that, you know, will never happen. Well, when you find an official patent application that goes through this stuff directly, that's exactly what you say. And with the NSA stuff that's going on right now, that is exactly correct. There is nothing in law that would prohibit that. And really what the bill is really intended to do is to begin the conversation of exactly how much of your privacy do you want to give up. And by the way, do you have control over it? Which right now you have little, if any, control over any of this. Current law does not address the item that we put in that bill.
Well, which underscores the reason why we should be having some sort of public debate about this kind of thing. But, you know, Congressman, I had sort of drawn a line between online, because as I've always told my children, I'm sure you've told yours, nothing you put online right. is private. Everybody, you know, make sure you wouldn't want something your grandmother could see or whatever. So, I mean, it bothered me. It didn't bother me as much as it bothers Jim, because I kind of don't expect privacy online. This is your house, though. This is sort of, you know, all the analogies, you know, Fahrenheit 451 and George Orwell, et cetera. It's just so crazy to think people would accept this.
And for me, it's all about notice to the consumer, even the online stuff. I agree with you, but I also would argue that if the government or if a private company is using my online information for a specific reason, they should tell me. And if I choose right. to do that, then, you know, that's fine. And it's the same thing here. If you want your advertisement to be targeted directly to you, your mood, or who you're with, or what you're doing, that's fine by me. I don't really care. But if you don't want it, you should be able to opt out of it, and opt out of it easily without losing anything. For instance, if you could opt out of it, but then the cable company would say, well, okay, you can opt out, but you can only get channels 1 through 10. You know, that's not a viable answer either. It has to be, you know, either in or out for this one item.
And we should say, by the way, this is not some out of some liberal think tank. You were co-sponsoring this thing with Walter Jones, who's a conservator yep. from one of the Carolinas, right?
That's right, yes. And honestly, the biggest problem I've had with this is that the few people I've talked to about it, they kind of look at me like you have three heads. I mean, Mike, this can't be real. This has to be crazy. And the answer is, I wish it were. I don't. This is not what I wanted to ever find. I wish there was this was science fiction. But unfortunately, like it or not, it is potentially real. I'm not the one who filed the patent application.
I just want to say it. Maybe I shouldn't say this on air, but I started to say it. The pajama top you were wearing while you were watching Homeland last night, Congressman, was really fetching. Hey, Mike Capuano, before you go, you've taken some heat. You were one of the ones, Democrats, who's criticized the administration. You're an early supporter of Barack Obama,
yeah.
criticized the administration for the NSA stuff. Then the blowback from some of your colleagues to the likes of you has been, hey, you're the problem. You didn't request briefings on these things.
That's
you could have found out about it. You chose not to. How do you plead to that, Mike Capuano?
First of all, you can't find out about it. That's the whole issue. Only a handful of people knew about it on the appropriate committees of Intel. And the problem is, in my estimation, from what I now know, they seem to have been captured by the people they were supposed to be doing their oversight of. So therefore, how could I possibly have asked about a program I did not know existed? By the way, I voted against the Patriot Act because I figured programs like this could exist. I did not know, nor could I have known, that they were doing it. But you know, this is the problem with when you give up so much of your privacy, is that the people who are doing it, first of all, they're always doing it. And I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. They're doing it out of good intentions to protect us. I get that, and I accept that. But you know what? I am the government, and I certainly don't trust the government with that kind of information. If they have bad people, there are ways to get them. There are ways to surveil them that I support. But we are not all suspects, and the best intentions don't change that.
We're talking with Congressman Michael Capuano about the We Are Watching You Act. Congressman, you have a provision in your legislation that if a Verizon customer or whoever customer decides that they want to have this watching stuff in their house, there has to be something on the screen.
It says, we are watching you.
I love this.
I just want people to know what's
yeah.
going on in their life. I mean, if that's your choice, good
yeah.
luck.
I'm not
trying to kill the technology. And like anything else, I mean, right now there's some discussion about the current Xbox, exactly what kind of information it will be gathering and what we'll be doing with it. But that, you know, that it is the beginning. It is not the end. It's technology is not going to stop, nor do I want it to stop. There may be some good uses for these types of things in the future, but again, they should be your choices, not the choice of the company or the country.
Hey, Mike Capiano, last thing from me. What was your reaction? I was really disappointed when I saw these Pew Research survey results the other day that from, depending on what the question was, from somewhere from 54 to 62% of Americans said they found this surveillance, even if it was an intrusion into their privacy, an acceptable thing on the part of the government. What's your analysis of why the American people are where they are on this?
I can't answer the question. I mean, to me, I always thought that America was made up of strong individualists that understand fully well we need a government. I am a pro-government type of person. I've been most of my life I've been accused of being a big government, overspending liberal. But at the same time, I think there's an appropriate role for government and there are inappropriate roles for government. And I would hope that more people, as they come to realize that we're not just talking about catching bad guys here. We're talking about every single law-abiding American. And I think it's an issue that brings the left and the right together to say, wait a minute, we want good, strong anti-terrorist activity, but the way to go about it is not to put us all in the category of suspects. I've seen some of those polls. I don't know what questions they're asking. I don't know who they're polling. I have not met anyone personally that has supported the NSA's action. There are different people of different degrees of reaction to it. But everyone I know, including Marjorie, you just said you weren't as worried about it as Jim, but don't tell me you support it. You know, just maybe you're not losing any sleep over it.
And I wanted to know about it. I think your point is I want to know about it. I want to have a debate about it. But I do want to know about it. Congressman, thanks so much for taking the time for being with us.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
And I love the name of your legislation, the We Are Watching You Act. Thank you very much.
Take care.
So as I said, a majority of Americans say they are fine with the level of NSA surveillance so far. But here's the question. Would you be okay with this? The number is 877-301-8970. You know, I don't want to lord it over you, Marjorie, but every single time we discussed the NSA surveillance last week, what did I say to you? Every single time we had the discussion.
You said they're going to have cameras in your house.
And what did you say every time?
I would not like that.
Well, no. And you also, that's ridiculous. Jim, you know, it's one thing, the email and the telephone calls, you know, that's one thing.
Uh-huh.
But Jim, when you're really exaggerating the possibilities here by saying they have a camera in your house. Mm-hmm. This is unbelievable. They could be watching you as you're watching television, gauging your mood with some sort of sensors.
Yep.
And as Mike Capuano says, apparently the technology exists, and this is not some fantasy. Major communications companies have requested patents with great details about what they want to know. So we want to know, for those of you, the 54 to 62% of you, who in the Pew Research Center polls have said, we find this surveillance level to protect us to be acceptable, would you be okay with this? And the important part is this, is what I said to Capuano in the middle of the interview. It's a bother if the company itself is checking you out. But Verizon is one of the companies that the government went to after they went to the FISA court and said, give us your stuff. They could have them give stuff on your viewing habits and actually see you sitting on your couch.
Some people might like
watching
that.
Television.
Some people might like that, Jim. There's a lot of voyeurs types out there. What do you call people at the other end of the voyeurs?
Voyeurs.
Yeah, no, those are the voyeurs. Ones that want to watch. The
voyeurs.
This could be a real breakthrough for the voyeurs among us. And lonely, you know, you could talk back to the television set, the elderly that are kind of stuck in their
You're
apartments.
Appalled by this. Are you not? Are you not?
Yes, I am appalled by
this.
And by
the way, this notion that it
And
please,
I think people view this entirely differently as your email than your emails.
And by the way, you know what people are going to say? Well, as long as Congressman Capuano and Congressman Jones from North Carolina are successful and we can opt out of it, it's fine. No, it's not fine. I mean, I admire Capuano doing what he's doing. They shouldn't be able to do this. They should. He says, this is the one place I disagree. If you want to opt into it, it's fine. I don't want to opt into it. I don't want to opt out of it. I don't want them to be doing this. End of discussion. 877-301-8970. It's like a science fiction movie where people would be shaking their heads,
right,
saying, you know why the movie's not that good? It's not believable.
Well, maybe someone remembers because I don't. So I read it a million years ago, but Fahrenheit 451, where you had the television sets on all four of your walls. Were they watching you as well? They probably were. Maybe someone will probably know where they were actually watching you in Fahrenheit 451 to know what you were doing. But, you know, you do see this already online where you go on to, for example, Amazon.com, and based on the music you've bought before and based on the books you've bought before, they recommend other books and other music, and they are probably recommending other products based on...
So it's fine with you, right?
No, Jim, it is not. It is not fine with me. You don't have to worry about lording it over me. You know why, Jim?
What's that?
Why should today be any different?
Let's
go to Mary in Cambridge. Hi, Mary.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Oh, okay. Hi. I am not fine with the NSA surveillance. I don't like it at all. I love my privacy. I want to keep it. End of story. The thing that I would like to find out, if they're going to go ahead with this, because every month I look at my Verizon bill, and I see all these things that say, wireless surcharges, governmental surcharges, taxes, fees, and it doesn't explain what exactly they're for. So if they're going to get consumers to have to pay for these fees and surcharges, what are the consumers going to get out of it? And I'll give you an example. If my house is broken into and they've been watching me, obviously they must have been watching whoever broke into my house.
Mm-hmm.
Can I use those surveillance tapes?
Yes, you can. If you pay them $99.95, they will send you a tape of the robber. Mary, I'm totally with you. Thanks for the call. 877-301-8897. There's no limit to this, by the way. I would not a day ago I would have said this is preposterous. And today it's this, the television watching you. Tomorrow it's going to be something else.
Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org, and Sandra just emailed to say that she thinks this is already happening. One morning her husband and she could not turn on the television set. They were told there was some sort of code there by Comcast, and that the government does this kind of thing in an emergency.
Well, you know, what's interesting, by the way, is that Capuano, the Globe article, mentions the patent was denied. And he made the point, which I hadn't thought of, is the reason patents are generally denied is because the technology already exists.
Right.
So the assumption is maybe somebody's using this and we don't know about it.
I guess to be on the safe side, we should all be careful what we're doing in front of our television.
Exactly. Really.
Make sure you're not in your underwear, or if you are in your underwear, it's attractive underwear, the kind your mother would say you'd be okay in, should you be taken to the hospital in an accident. Barbara in Rhode Island. What do you think, Barbara?
Oh, listen, you darlings. I have been listening to you most of my 85 years.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Glad to do it. And I have a television nearly as old, and I would be happy to throw that thing into the front yard with its peeping Tom operation working so they could see, one, that I don't love them anymore and that my lawn needs mowing. And the other is, this is particularly for you, because we're such fashionistas.
Right.
What are you wearing to watch television?
Exactly.
Well, by the way, you know, Barbara, what they will do, if you read this patent application, they'll see what you're wearing, and then all of a sudden you'll start getting ads for, if you're wearing a robe, you got ads for fashionable robes. If you're drinking a Budweiser, as it says here, you'll get a beer ad. So, you know, while we're all making light of this, this is exactly what the point is. Barbara, thanks for the call, as always.
It said that if you are humming a happy song, they're going to presume that you're in a good mood and react to you. I'm not sure what that means. I'll send you good mood advertising or products, whatever. But they're going to listen to you singing songs in your house. They can hear you. And then the infrared thing, where the heat sensors, like they did with the Sonaya from the boat.
Sonaya, yeah.
Yes, tell where you're sitting in your living room. Are you sitting next to your spouse, across the room from your spouse? Do you have a new boyfriend and you're cuddling? And as you said, if you're cuddling, they'll send you ads for not just, you know, sex products, but weekend getaways and romantic movies and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty strange.
Rob, you're on Cape Cod. You're on with Jim and Margie on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call. Hey, Rob.
Hey, I think you're on the right track when the representative said that this has probably been patent denied because it was prior art.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big blow-up in 2008 and 2009. A reporter by the name of Chris Albrecht made a report after talking to a Comcast VP whose last name was Kunkel. He was director of the customer experience. And they were experimenting with cable boxes that had these infrared cameras so they could figure out which individuals in the family were in the room. The their side of it would be that they get to do targeted advertising based on whether or not the person was a male or a female of some particular age, whether there were, he was alone or multiple people was in the room. Another aspect would be that they could identify who the individual was and bring up that person's DVR selections so that they wouldn't have to, the family could discriminate between what the kids wanted recorded and what the dad wanted recorded.
Hey, Rob, how long ago was this? How long ago?
This was March 2008 when the first articles came out, and they continued to talk about it through 2009. So I'm sure there were technological hardware examples of this.
Well, you know, it's, I don't know whether there was some level of outrage, but my sense is the reason why Capuano may get some traction on this, the congressman, is because it comes the week after all this NSA stuff.
Right.
If this had happened 3 weeks ago, I think we'd all just smile or laugh or say, wow, technology is amazing, and move on.
It had a particular ick factor in response to the articles back then, and I didn't hear much about it after 2009. I think it got dropped because the market was just not going to accept that kind of intrusion. Not surprised to see it come back because, you know, that's what they tend to do. Look how long it took us to get the video phone, and now we have video phone.
Hey, Rob, thanks for the update. We appreciate your call.
George just emailed and said, wouldn't it be quite the scandal if we found out that the government was already watching us using this technology, just as they were already taking our stuff from the Internet without our knowledge?
Do you find that to be a preposterous suggestion? I don't.
No. And you know what else I find preposterous? Everybody loves Skype. Well, I guess it's great as long as you're doing, you know, you're talking to one of your children in college or maybe your spouse is away. But anybody who's doing anything untoward on Skype, I think you've got to be out of your mind.
No, it's the end of untouardicity in this country is, I believe that's the word, because of what we learned in the last week.
No more slithering on Skype.
Let's go to Ray. You're in Woburn. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Thank you, Ray.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Pleasure.
I got a direct comment about the television feedback loop and also a follow-up to it that is sure to blow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
I know it. Videodrome, a movie from back in 83 with David Cronenberg film with James Woods and mm-hmm. Deborah Harry. This tape, 8-track tape, gets passed around that people are playing and it starts infecting everybody's television sets. And a hand comes out and it shoves another video cassette right into your stomach, into your body.
What's this called? Videodrome?
Get this. The trailer for this movie, I'm looking at it right now. It says, first, it controls your mind. Then it destroys your body. Now, here is my follow-up to this, because you're not going to believe this. If you go to physics.org,
yeah.
This is breaking all over the science magazines now. Quantum teleportation between atomic systems over long distances. Make a long story short, they figured out a way of maintaining quantum entanglement for a long enough period of time where they could shoot a quantum beam through two different gas clouds and move information that is completely undetectable while it's in transport because it's entangled. You can't break the code. And recreate it in the second cloud. What this means is, very simply, this is according to the Niels Bohr Institute, University of Copenhagen. They can take anything that they can create the information for, transport it with by light beam, and recreate it, whether it's a physical object or a human being. So here's the tie between the two things.
Yeah.
Verizon gets going. They got this television thing. Marjorie and Jim are sitting on a couch. Not only does it watch them, but it comes out and zaps them, and they're gone into the TV set.
Well,
oh, God.
I'll tell you, that would be a really horrible way to end it all.
I guess she'd better get her affairs in order.
For the call. That was an upbeat.
Yeah,
did you ever hear of Videodrome? It's Deborah Harry from Blondie.
I've heard of Videodrome. I never saw it. I'm not sure I want to watch it. God, this is terrific. Let's go to Susan from Lowell. Susan, what do you think? Are you going to be zapped into the TV set too?
Well, I think I'm going to give up all technology. But there are opportunities for investment after all this surveillance hullabaloo. For one thing, if you invest in no-name cell companies, you might prosper. Netflix will probably come back because nobody will want to watch cable, but they'll get all the episodes of series and movies, et cetera, on DVDs.
Yeah.
Libraries will again be on the rise, which is a good thing in my opinion, because nobody will want to use Google. and bookstores, the lovely neighborhood bookstores that could serve your every need will come back because nobody will even trust Amazon.
This is a cup three quarters full kind of woman, let me tell you.
But it is part of the trade-off, isn't it, Susan? I mean, you know, that we want to be able to do all these things just sitting on our computer, whether it's shopping, you know, buying books, getting all our information. And then at the same time, we want it to be totally private. I just don't know how we can have both things simultaneously.
I don't think we can have both things.
And neither do I.
I think, frankly, the cocooning, you know, we're going toward cocooning more and more, and I think it's to the detriment of our mental health and our social expertise. You know, we're no longer very good at being social unless it's on Facebook or...
Well, that goes without a shadow of a doubt. Human-to-human contact is almost so yesterday.
Oh, it's overrated.
It's ridiculous.
I know.
Susan, thanks. That was a great analysis of the situation here, I guess. there
bleak.
Is sort of a bright side, I guess you can say. But
well,
the dark side
fun
is yours.
Of me, being What's the Unabomber it? Over here.
No, I mean, there are a lot of people who are anti-technology for some of these kinds of reasons. And I think what we've learned in the last week, being capped by this We Are Watching You Act, being filed by Representative Capuano and Representative Jones from North Carolina, is maybe it's going to educate us a little bit. I just hope if a poll was taken in a week, that it would be different from what we saw in this Pew Research Center.
People don't want
people
spying on them in their houses. They absolutely do not. I'm convinced of that.
Let's go to Nancy. Nancy and Falmouth. I'm sorry. Nancy, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Nancy.
Just exactly was going to say what you just said.
What's that?
And that is that I don't think the polls are reflecting what's going to happen when people really realize what is possible here with the government spying. And I don't think that people, it's set in with them. You know, it's just something that, if once they start thinking about it, we'll be outraged. I don't think there's going to be 51% of people not caring.
Yeah, but you know what the problem is? When we're being surveyed, they're going to be watching us, and we're going to get zapped if we give the wrong answer, according to that caller.
Right.
So we are, they
That's
got
right.
us coming and going.
It'll be like the electric shocks, Nancy. You know, they'll keep upping it every time you give the wrong answer, a higher and higher voltage,
hey,
like
Nancy,
in that movie with Robert De Niro.
Thank you. I hope you are right. No, it's just, it's a frightening thing, and the most frightening part, I am so glad Capuano, the congressman, said what he said about these surveys. What are people thinking? I mean, that was his basic, and that's where I am on this, and that's where I think ultimately you're going to end up being, Marjorie.
Okay. I think the internet is different than your living room, Jim. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's where I am. Coming up, Callie Crossley joins us for her headlines of the week and some stories that went under the radar. There's one particular story here that should have been way above the radar. I'm going to tell you about that up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. She joins us every Friday, and you join her every Sunday at 6:30 in the evening on Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. And here she is. Hi, Callie Crossley.
Hi, Jim Browdy. Hi, Marjorie Egan.
You know what really got me going when I read your stories this week was the story about Google and Microsoft wanting computer science education in the schools, and I was stunned that we don't already have this.
No, not to the degree that would prevent them from hiring all the folks that they hire overseas. So what they want to do, and by the way, they do want to put some money into it, which I think is important to say because we all know this, the educational funds are still always limited, is, you know, put some courses in every school and build a curriculum. Now, they're getting some pushback, surprisingly, because folks are saying it's not that easy to sort of just overnight do this, and then maybe what would be a reasonable response would be to target a couple of schools, make them magnet schools or, you know, just specialty schools in computer science, use all the curriculum that they're talking about, see how that works. But boy, it really just takes you to another place when you think about the possibilities for the kids that could graduate with this. We're already talking about trying to bridge gaps with folks coming out of community colleges. What if the kids got it in high school and, you know, they're already 2 years ahead?
What also stunned me, and people know this from kids they know that are like little computer savvy kids at 4 and 3 years old, they're waiting until the 8th grade.
Yes.
I mean, you know, if we're going to stay...
We're talking Massachusetts right now.
Right, we're talking Massachusetts. And we're talking about they're not being job ready for all these high-tech jobs because kids come out of high school or community colleges. We just can't compete with kids from other countries. So to me, they should be starting this in kindergarten so that kids can keep a pace because that's when you absorb so much of the skill. I mean, everybody knows these six-year-olds that you're embarrassed. I mean, they're doing 9,000 things on the computer and on their little iPads or their parents' iPads that I have no idea how to do.
And, you know, we can look around the world and see how it happened easily in countries where, you know, they didn't have phone service. We're talking landlines.
Right.
And they just leaped across all of that technology and went straight to computer tech. And training for some folks, like in India, there's great source for all these companies for engineers because they spend a lot of money just concentrating on courses and curriculum to train people to know this. You know, they never even had the other technology. They went straight to this and they're getting all the jobs.
You know, many times we've discussed job openings and unemployment with Governor Patrick when he's with us. And by the way, he'll be with us noon to one on Tuesday. We should bring this up with him. He talks about the fact that there's so many jobs open despite the unemployment rate where people don't have the skills. And he talks like you about community colleges and stuff. I have to say that part of the story in the Globe that you talked about by Michael Farrell a couple of days ago, tech firms call for mandatory computer classes, the reluctance of particularly since the companies themselves are willing to ante up to pay part of the bill. And my guess is if you strong arm, they may pay all of the bill. Is the reluctance of education officials to say, let's just do this as fast as we possibly can? I really don't get it at all, even though generally I understand you need pilot programs, you have to do whatever. This need is so obvious, just do it.
Well, they got to have teachers, so they figure some teachers they'd want to train who are already in place, then they'd have to have some other, then they have to have a curriculum. So they're, you know, so the critics are saying, it's not that we don't want it, we want it, and if you want to pay for it, yes, but, you know, we need some time. But you know what this is? This is exactly what a lot of the folks who are looking digitally and technologically say is the nimble world versus the world that cannot adapt
in the moment. The bureaucratic world.
And it is a lot of bureaucracy, but also just a question of adaptation sort of on a dime, if you will. And it wouldn't be that fast, but for schools that have to, you know, roll back a lot of stuff to get this stuff in, even in the simplest way, it is a lot to think about.
By the way, you made a good point about the, you know, teachers with these skills. There's a solution to that, too, which will not upset the unions that I am friendly with, that Marjorie is not. Let these companies that need these workers so bad, let them contribute teachers for an interim period. Let me finish, Marjorie, until the teachers in the existing infrastructure are adequately trained, and then they replace them, and then they take those positions. So no net jobs are lost.
Teach for America was putting volunteer college kids into schools across the country to try to improve the quality of education. You know what happened to those kids.
Yeah, this is a different situation.
The unions went after them.
I understand, but I just came up with a solution.
You're talking about side-by-side teaching. It's sort of like I go to some journalism conferences. I go to a lot of journalism conferences, and Google is almost a presence there. They have courses that they teach the journalists, but it's a side-by-side thing. Most people are not coming with nothing, so they can build on that. But it's a similar kind of situation, and then you're on your own, and if you want to check back with them, you can, but they're not moving into newsrooms to do this.
Right.
They're just trying to get you up on how best to use some of the most recent technology. So it's something that I hope doesn't go away because we got, by the way, in this pool of people who want to do this and put their money into it, our competitors. Just to be clear.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
And, you know, and one last thing too about this. I mean, I've never been a math person, so my geometry and algebra classes were never mind calculus were totally wasted on me. But to look at the curriculum in a 2013 kind of way and say, you want to know a certain amount of history, obviously, you want to know a certain amount of civics and stuff, but what you really need is to be very, very computer nimble, or you're not going to be employed in a lot of fields that are exploding.
Exactly.
Do you also see they want to, I don't know if you said this already, they want to add an MCAS requirement here.
Yes.
The standardized testing, which is now whatever it is, English, math, I think history has been added, that sort of thing. But have a computer science. I mean, it's so critical. It's why it's so, regardless of what you're doing, whether you're writing, you're speaking, you're adding, you're subtracting, whatever you're doing, computer literacy, massive computer literacy, maybe to the point where you can actually do a job in the industry, is huge. Just do it.
And by the way, right now they're guessing there's maybe about 5,000 jobs are available if they had the kids trained in it. So we're you know, this
How
is not chump
is
change.
That?
This is not chump change. This is a very serious business.
We will bring this up actually with the governor on Tuesday because this is
this is right
in his wheelhouse. And, and by the way, his own Secretary of Education, Mitchell Chester, is quoted in this piece, and he's one of the people who said, where is he in this thing? Do you see this here?
Yeah.
He's the one that cautions there's got to be some, here he is. It's a matter of, this is, I mean, I understand this. It's a matter of balancing a worthwhile goal against the universe of finite resources and where there are many important goals. And I understand that, but this one, one would argue, should be right at the top.
They put him in the charter schools.
I don't want us to leave any money on the table, frankly. You know.
But you know what the other problem, I mean, now that I'm thinking about this, I want to argue, I rarely argue both sides. I'm about to argue the other side against myself.
Yes.
The legislature, which I'm sure would all be shaking its head saying, yeah, this is really important, Kelly and Marjorie. Mm-hmm. How much did the legislature agree to fund of the governor's billion-dollar education, including early education initiative?
There
Not a nickel.
Yeah,
so the question is, I guess what Chester is reflecting, the education commissioner, is you got to walk the walk in addition to talking the talk. They all care about this, but it's got to be funded, and it's got to be one of those private public partnership where the private sector puts up a ton of dough.
So, Kelly Crossley, there's a bathroom building craze going on in New Hampshire. What's going on?
Well, it's in the Senate, actually, and it's going to, you know, trickle down to New Hampshire or trickle up as you would. There are 20 senators, as we know, in Congress right now in the Senate. Never have had that many. That seems like a lot, but in the aggregate, it's really not. But it's everybody's talking and looking at what they're doing on the floor, not to mention the whole military, the sexual assault military legislation that they've gotten together across party lines to fund. Having said that, where they would like to get together more but don't have space is the bathrooms. There are no bathrooms.
I love this.
Not enough bathroom stalls in the Congress, in the Senate, because what? They weren't expecting to have this many women. So they're building like crazy to do this. And as we know in our own New Hampshire, there are many, many women now elected to the legislature, including the governor. So this should be a trend. But, you know, I looked at it and I sort of said, ah, ha, ha, that's interesting. It's funny. More stalls. We women know about that. And then I realized that it actually is more significant than I first my first response to it as kind of a light thing. And that is, if you think about bathrooms, they're really the leading edge into cultural change in this country. Now, to
that's
ways.
A great point.
No,
go ahead. You are right. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know. So first, let's start with the civil rights movement. White and colored restrooms. All right.
Yep.
The Civil Rights Act was about making equal accommodations in facilities like bathrooms, but bathrooms were an issue. We are in the midst now of fighting about, and we'll be doing this story on Under the Radar as well, about transgender people in bathrooms. We had that discussion somewhat here in Massachusetts. Right now, there's a Maine teenager fighting for her right to use the female bathroom. And let's go then to the top of the corporate chain, Sheryl Sandberg. If you've listened to her TED Talk, she really recounts this incident where she's sitting in this meeting with all these high-level guys, and she's the only woman in the room, of course. They say, okay, well, let's take a break, you know, go take a little potty break. And she gets up, and then she's realized that the head guy is looking at her kind of embarrassed. And she says, what? And he goes, there's no female bathroom. And she says, what? That means no woman has ever been in this room with you all at this point.
That's
so
great.
So we are talking about bathrooms as the cutting edge of cultural change in America.
By the way, you too can have as many stalls as you want as long as you don't take away any of my urinals.
That's you know what I really think to really make things even? Because as we all know, you go to Gillette Stadium or Fenway, there's 9 million women waiting in line and no men.
Thank you.
We should have unisex bathrooms. The urinals will all be enclosed. You go do your business on one side. Because we are always waiting forever. The men are zipping in and zipping out.
By the way, you mentioned New Hampshire. Jean Shaheen, who's the former governor and senator, I didn't realize till this morning, she's the only woman that's ever been both a governor and a United States senator. We should not let it pass that New Hampshire is spearheading this thing in the Senate because it's the only state that has every single member of Congress, two in the House, two in the Senate, who are women. As you said, the governor, Maggie Hassan, was just elected a couple of months ago. It's just, it is really, it's amazing. I'll give you a quiz, Kelly.
Yes.
We are next to a state that has 4 out of 4 members of Congress who are women, 100%. How many women has Massachusetts sent to Washington in the history of the Commonwealth? How many women total, House and Senate? The number is staggering. Remember, there are four currently from New Hampshire today. How many women ever from Massachusetts?
Well, there's Nikki Tsongas and there's Elizabeth Warren.
That's two. How many more?
Margaret Heckler.
That's three.
Okay. Is that Chase Smith woman a million
that
years
was from,
ago?
No, she's from Maine. Margaret Chase Smith was a senator
from
Maine.
There was an earlier one from Massachusetts, wasn't there?
Two other women from Massachusetts.
Louise Day Hicks,
woman whose name I can't remember. I think her name was Norse Rogers or something. She was the wife of somebody who died. So essentially, in 200 and some years, we've had only one more woman member of Congress in one of the most progressive states in America than New Hampshire has as we sit here. It's pretty amazing.
It's pretty amazing.
And we have elected almost no women statewide either. Right?
That is correct. We've elected Shannon O'Brien, who was here last week.
Yep.
Martha Coakley. And
Elizabeth Warren.
Well, no, that's not statewide.
But that's about it.
And Jane Swift and Evelyn Murphy, but they weren't elected in their own right. They were elected as part of a team with a man who was...
pretty bad.
You know, it's one of the... Again, I haven't been on a side of this battle, but the fact that women have to fight for this as all, as opposed to saying, can you please do this? Wasn't Jane Swift's initiative, one of her major initiatives, was a nursing room?
Yes.
And wasn't there this whole brouhaha?
Yep.
It was going to take away a men's bathroom, and there are about 50 of them at the State House on the fourth floor or something. Didn't you write about this?
And guess whose office used to be right across the hall?
Was it Scott Brown?
The lactation room, as they called it, was Scott Brown.
Scott Brown,
yeah. He was tucked away in a corner before it became world famous. Yeah.
Oh my God.
He was helping the mothers.
And we'll look back on all of this, you know, and just, you know, as we look back on white and colored bathrooms, you know, after the Civil Rights Act and say, what? You know, I mean, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
Same thing with transgender folks and same thing with women in the Senate.
So you had one other issue was the immigration thing with Mark Rubio.
Yes, Mark Rubio, as we know, from Florida, Republican, who is a part of the Gang of Eight pushing this immigration bill through that has the best chance of actually going through than anybody's seen in years. And he's been hanging on, even though his conservative pals have been beating him to death about being a part of what has to be a compromise bill on everybody's part if it's going to go forward. Well, he just came out and said, I think this pressure is just too much for him to make it clear that he is a conservative, and he has a line that he will draw. And the line that he's drawing is if Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy gets his amendment through, which would grant green cards to foreign partners of gay unauthorized immigrants, then he's out. In fact, he uses a more clear phrase. He says, I'm done.
By the way, the same rights that would be granted under the bill to heterosexual couples.
Right.
But, you know, Leahy, who I think is a very decent man and is chair of the judiciary, I think he's chair of the Judiciary Committee, dropped his amendment in committee because he realized that this might sink the whole bill. And I think the reality is unjust as it. They talk about how we don't want social. This is what Rubio's quote. We don't want social issues getting caught up in this thing where one would argue it's basic equity kinds of things and equal treatment. The reality is the Democrats are going to have to essentially give this one up unless they want the thing to be deep sixth in the Senate. That's the reality.
You raised this a few months ago when we were talking about this, and I thought, will it get to this point? Well, it got there, and I think it just pushed Mark Rubio up against the wall, and he just can't go anywhere. I mean, as it is, the other thing that he's standing on is that there has to be very strong border security, but, you know, who can define that?
Before there's any pathway.
Yeah. You know, but who can define that? I mean, this is the best chance this bill has got. I guess the question is similar to the kinds of questions that were being asked when that gun law, pitiful that it was going through. Is it better to have something than nothing?
Well, you know, the great line, and I get it wrong every time, but one of President Obama's great lines was don't let the perfect be the
enemy of the good. Yes.
And, you know, while as a, you know, person of principle, which I like to think we all are, you say to yourself, you got to fight for this because it's basic fairness. The bottom line is it may sink the whole bill, and that's a calculation they have to make. And I think the liberal Democrats are going to say, 3/4 of a loaf, which we didn't think we were going to get at all, is better than no loaf at all. And I think that's what they'd end up with.
I'm not sure about this, but I think if the Supreme Court gets rid of DOMA, and
that is true.
That will solve the problem, won't it?
I think it would solve the
legally,
problem.
Legally, it will?
Yeah, I think it would. But, I mean, that's a very good point. We're going to find out about that in a couple of days, the Defense of Marriage Act, and we'll find out what the Supreme Court's going to do. Callie, it's a pleasure, as always. We'll be
listening
Sunday at 6:30.
We'll
see you next Friday.
Callie Crossy is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossy, and you can catch her, as Jim says, 6:30 here every Sunday night at 89.7 WGBH. Thanks, Callie, as always. It has been 6 months since a very sad day, I should say, the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut. When we come back, we're going to talk to Scarlett Lewis. Her son Jesse was among the victims killed in that mass shooting. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
I'm Ibi Caputo. I live here and I report here. I found out where the Boston bombers lived was on my own street.
The normalcy was stunning, given that the street had been cordoned off to residents.
When I was reporting for WGBH Radio from my own block, it really brought home the synergy between living in a community and working in that same community.
FBI, police, and SWAT teams did their
work. Ibi Caputo, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the 2013 Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, July 26th, 27th, and 28th in Boston's Copley Square. You can learn more at bostonsummerarts.com. And Fruitlands Museum, 4 historic exhibition buildings and over 200 acres of meadows and trails. Now through June, presenting Visions, Tim Hetherington, a photojournalism exhibit. More at fruitlands.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. As Marjorie said, Jesse McCord Lewis was one of 20 kids and 6 educators who were killed in Newtown, Connecticut 6 months ago today. I met Jesse's mother, Scarlett, in Dorchester at the Mother's Day March for Peace, where parents and children and partners of those whose lives were ended by senseless violence spoke of those lives and how to end this madness in the future. Scarlett Lewis also heads the Jesse Lewis Choose Love Foundation. She's kind enough to join us today. Thanks so much for your time, Scarlett.
Thank you, Jim.
Hi, Scarlett. This is Marjorie. You know, Scarlett, I was reading about your little boy, Jesse, and I read how he had written little boy misspellings, I guess, but this is what he meant, nurturing, healing, and love on a wall, I believe, in your house. And I thought that said a lot about your son and said a lot about you as a mom. What was that about?
That was an incredible find. I had been living at my mom's house after the tragedy, and I came home after New Year's thinking that, you know, I had to make a new life for my son and I. And when we came home, we saw this message that Jesse had written. It had to be a couple days before he died, and it said, nurturing, healing, love. It was on a little chalkboard in the kitchen, and we were stunned by it. It was just something that when you looked at, it spoke directly to your soul, you know, because yeah. He was a rough and tumble 6-year-old little boy, and that was not in his vernacular. It truly, honestly wasn't in mine either. You know, I'm a full-time working single mother, and I really didn't know where that came from. And I started thinking about it and realizing that there was probably a spiritual awareness with him of maybe things to come, possibly, and the nurturing, healing love was meant as, and it was taken as comfort for myself and my son and my immediate family. But when I started thinking about those words, nurturing, healing love, I realized that they were also meant as inspiration for the world. I looked at how the world reacted to this tragedy, which was really coming together as one in compassion. And I thought, you know, how can I keep this going, this nurturing, healing love that everybody has been showing us, which is so beautiful. And so that's why I started the foundation.
And what's the goal, Scarlett Lewis, what's the goal with the foundation? What are you hoping to achieve?
Well, I have dedicating my life to be in service to others and to spread the message of nurturing, healing love. And when the tragedy happened, I really looked within and I thought, you know, what is the major issue here? How could something like this happen? And to me, when I was talking about it with my family, we really felt like it was anger in our society. And what happens is, you know, and anger is a normal thing. Everybody has it, but you get, you know, these feelings, and when they're prolonged and you really don't know how to handle it, sometimes we blame others for our anger. You know, it's your fault that I'm angry.
Yeah.
And in doing so, we become victims, and we render ourselves powerless to change that anger. Now, when you're powerless, that can lead to rage, And I really feel like rage is what is filling up our prison systems and can lead to something like this horrific mass murder at Sandy Hook Elementary. So I started thinking about how do you change that dynamic in society? And I really thought about it and thought that, you know, this whole incident started with a thought in Adam Lanza's head at one point. And a thought can be changed. So the goal of the Jesse Lewis Choose Love Foundation is to really go into schools and work with teachers and parents, because we're all in this together, and develop an awareness that we have that choice, that we can choose loving thoughts over angry thoughts, and how to do that and how it feels. And that, of course, includes the concept of compassion. It includes the concept of living a life in gratitude rather than entitlement. Just all those age-old wisdoms that, you know, we all kind of inherently know, but we all have to think about every day. I mean, think about it. You wake up in the morning and you choose love or not, I don't know, 20 times a day. I know I do.
Yeah. Yeah, with the clerk at the Dunkin' Donuts and the person that's taking your ticket. I mean, you can choose how you treat people. I mean, that's I mean, it's interesting, Scarlett. By the way, we're talking with Scarlett Lewis, who lost her little boy, Jesse, in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting last December. You know, a lot of the parents have focused. As a matter of fact, there were a bunch of parents. Well, the sister of Victoria Soto, who was your little boy's teacher, was down yesterday in Washington with Harry Reid. They're talking about trying again for the background check legislation, trying to get that through. That clearly is not your focus. Some families have reacted one way. You've reacted another way, obviously.
You know, I think that every effort and all the families are kind of going in different directions. But in the end, we're all headed towards the same goal. And that is making this world a better place and trying to help this horrific tragedy that happened to us to not happen to anybody else, to keep our kids safe. And we are all working towards that one unified goal, regardless of what we're doing, if we're doing guns, if we're doing education, if we're doing mental health. These are all great things, and they're all going to get us to that place.
Hey, Scarlett Lewis, I read on a number of occasions that it's believed that when your kid died, he was actually, you talked about him being a rough and tumble little six-year-old, that he was actually trying to save other kids. Is that apocryphal or is that true as far as you know?
You know, as far as I know, and the criminal investigation is not completed yet, but from people that were there, the story is that he yelled out to nine kids that were at a different area of the classroom, run, run now. And this was after Adam had entered the classroom and started shooting. His gun ran out of bullets, so he was reloading. And it was during this time that Jesse yelled to those kids, and those kids were able to escape.
You know, Scarlett Lewis, you just referred to the mass murderer here by his first name. And, you know, I know what you've done with your life since this. I know about the foundation, and I got a chance to talk to you for a couple of minutes in Dorchester a month or so ago. What's your – how do you view him? How do you view Lanza, Adam Lanza?
That's a controversial subject, obviously. You know, I just – almost instantaneously realized that someone who was capable of doing something like he did was clearly not in his right mind. Anybody in their right mind would never do what he did. And, you know, his mother and he died, you know, while doing it, and, you know, paid the ultimate price, as did our children. And, you know, I understand personally that walking around with black leaden anger in my heart is not a good thing for me. Mm-hmm. And it may be a little bit easier for me to take that point of view because Adam's dead, and so is his mother. I don't have to see their faces. I don't have to live through a trial, thankfully. And so I just made the decision early on, you know, to forgive. And that's a lesson also embedded in the message of the Jesse Lewis Choose Love Foundation. And that is, forgiveness is really for yourself, because a lot of times the person that you're forgiving either doesn't care or doesn't even realize the pain that he's caused you. And so in forgiving, you're forgiving for yourself to release that. And I've really made that decision in my own life.
You know, Scott, I also read that a friend of yours who knew a lot about Native American spirituality spoke about that the place where a person dies becomes sacred ground. And so you went back to Sandy Hook. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was, I don't believe in coincidences. So the person that was assigned to me, this beautiful, beautiful woman who is a healer, had just spoken to me that day. And that was, of course, within, you know, a week of this incident happening. I was in a bad place and having a really rough time. And she just happened to mention that the Native American belief that where their beloved died was sacred ground. And I took that with me and just kind of molded over. And I was actually, I actually came to my house to pick up a few things, and the Newtown police swooped in right behind me. I thought, oh my gosh. But it was actually an invitation to visit the school on Christmas Day. Now, I think if I hadn't been just given that message about the Native American tradition, I never would have done that. In my wildest dreams, it would have been too painful. But instead, when they asked me that, I said, absolutely, I'll go. And part of me also was thinking, this is Jesse lived through this. You know, I should be brave enough to go and face the school. So my family and I went in the afternoon on Christmas, and it was incredibly, incredibly difficult walking along that school, you know, the school that I have been going to for 9 years, because I have an older child too. And walking along the front of it, seeing all the windows boarded up, walking to the entrance, seeing all the entranceway boarded up, and there were some messages written by other family members. So we took out a Sharpie and wrote some hearts and messages to Jesse, and as we were standing there, I noticed on the ground there was still shattered glass, and I bent down to pick up a piece of glass, and I asked my family to do the same thing, and I said, you know what, let's just maybe use this as a talisman and keep it in our pocket, and, you know, when life gets tough, when we are facing an uncomfortable situation, something that's scary, or maybe something that we feel like is very difficult to do, let's think about, you know, what Jesse and his the other children and the teachers and administrators, let's think about what they did. And let's never again be afraid in our life. Let's lead a life based in faith and not fear. And let's just move forward, you know, and have this as a lesson. And it was a really powerful moment.
Well, you're a really powerful person, I should say, Scarlett Lewis. What's the website of the foundation if people want to either volunteer or contribute or help in some way, Scarlett Lewis?
Yeah, thank you very much. It's www.jessielewischooselove.org.
I hope you'll stay in touch with us. Scarlett Lewis, thanks so much
Scarlett,
for your time.
Thank you very much. And you've done a wonderful job with the website. It is very, very uplifting.
Thank you very much. That's what we try to do.
Well, you succeeded. It's wonderful. It's
we'll
absolutely
talk,
wonderful. Scarlett Lewis is the founder of the Jesse Lewis Choose Love Foundation. And as we said, her son, Jesse, was killed in the Newtown shootings. Up next, it is Open Mic with Emily Rooney. Stay tuned for that conversation. This is 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Philip Martin. I live here, and I report here. Without ever knowing it,
You've driven the same routes, passed the same landmarks, and used the same rest stops as today's human trafficking networks.
You know, I think I'm always in reporter mode.
Who's orchestrating this trafficking network from New York to New England?
And it's so important to be aware of the things that are going on in our life and to incorporate that into journalism.
Philip Martin, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Genuine Interactive, a full-service interactive agency that creates digital strategies, mobile apps, and social media strategies for local and national brands. You can learn more about this Boston-based agency at genuineinteractive.com. And WGBH 44, your new home for the best in public affairs. Friday nights catch the McLaughlin Group at 9, followed by Need to Know at 9:30, and Moyers & Company at 10. Lively debate and fresh insights, Friday on WGBH 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on open mic every Friday. The host of WGBH TV's Greater Boston joins us first to discuss some of the stories of the week, then to present the now legendary Emily's List. Now, Marjorie sees that list as a collection of complaints. I, of course, see it as a compendium of incredibly insightful observations.
Observations.
Welcome back, Emily.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay. I'll call it insightful observations.
Great.
From now on, Emily. So you were at the Paul Sallucci Memorial yesterday up at the State House.
I was.
Yeah, tell us about it.
I was actually incredibly moved. You're sitting there as a reporter taking notes and taking it all in, but I stopped at various points. First of all, just to see all the former and current constitutional officers the state has ever had that are still alive in one room was actually, and they had it all laid out according to who was who, and you know, treasurers sat next to treasurers, and it was really quite something. And then the four, living previous governors, and two of them spoke. Governor Bill Weld, he was fantastic. He was hilarious, but the one that really struck me, and she got a 2-minute standing ovation afterwards, was one time acting governor. Jane Swift. And I feel like it was almost like there was vindication. Everybody's sort of admitting that they gave her a hard time. Not just the media. Everybody gave her a hard time.
We should say, for those who weren't around for that, she was lieutenant governor of Paul Sallucci. Obviously, Paul Sallucci left fairly quickly to be the ambassador
in
to Canada.
In the second term.
In the second term, my apologies. And she was left to be the young acting and governor with no lieutenant governor.
She was acting governor during September 11th, and it was one of the most painful, awkward. You know, I remember her standing there with her arms crossed. Anyway, here's a little bit of what the run-up was. She was talking about all the opportunities that Governor Sallucci has given to people, and women in particular. Here's a little bit of what she said.
His appointment of Margaret Marshall as Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court was bold, inspiring, and historic as she became the first woman to lead a branch of government in our state. And he gave me the opportunity of a lifetime to govern the Commonwealth he loved.
Pretty moving, even
through
the headphones.
She was really choked up.
Well, you know what? She did. It was so sexist. She took a helicopter home.
I didn't mind that.
I defended
that.
Neither did I. If you have a newborn baby, it's your first child, your husband there is 3 hours away.
She lived in North Adams?
Yeah.
Or?
And the kid was really, really sick. She took how many guys have taken golf carts and golf rides, and they're out in the middle of the day playing golf, and she was crucified.
No, I had no problem with that. I was a big defender on that.
And when the kids were not sick, she was doing a 3-hour commute
every
day. And a commute back.
I was critical of her for that because
she should have moved to the city.
That's 6 hours of nonsense time. I don't care, cell phones, whatever. It's just a waste. I mean, 3 hours on the road, but 6 hours?
But at the same time,
helicopter every day.
But it was a difficult situation because she did not expect, obviously, Paul Sallucci to go become the ambassador to Canada.
No,
and then she was lieutenant governor. She had 3 children under 3.
By the way, she was sitting right next to Mitt Romney. And, of course, Mitt Romney was one who came and just bullied her right off the ticket.
Yeah.
She decided not to run for the office herself.
Did you watch the body language there or no?
They were very friendly. I was watching all the body language.
I'm sure you were, Okay, so from Sallucci yesterday to, I thought, a pretty startling front page headline in the Boston Globe today. FBI director, the outgoing director, that's Robert Mueller, admits to pre-bombing lapse. Let me read you the first paragraph. FBI director Robert Mueller acknowledged on Thursday that a lack of formal communication with the agency within the agency may have prevented investigators from alerting Russian authorities that Tamerlan Tsarnaev had returned to Russia. information that Russian officials say could have averted the act of terrorism. And then he goes on to say, this is Mueller, even if procedures had been fixed prior to the Boston bombing, do not think it would have stopped it. I am stunned that we continue to be so casual about the lack of information about whether or not maybe this thing could have been stopped. Bill Keating came back from Russia, the congressman, said it could have been prevented. The first person who said that, we have not heard one word from Congressman Keating since, which suggests to me that someone said, stop talking.
Well, or there's also some suggestion that he was duped by various people over there or told, gave him the party line or what he wanted to hear. So I don't know. I mean, Mueller was also incredibly defensive of the department. We should say that. And I actually looked at a couple different stories today. It was sort of interpretive. I mean, that was the way the Boston Globe interpreted it, that there was more to it, that possibly it could have been averted if there had been a better exchange of information with the Russians. But I don't know. Are we ever going to know?
Well, the thing I would like to know, I mean, they keep saying that the investigation is continuing into the guy that was killed in Orlando. Yes, that was allegedly in.
That's an outrage.
Why do we not know all these weeks later? He was shot. His father said seven times, including once in the top of the head. Is the FBI ever going to tell us, and is the medical examiner ever going to release the autopsy results? This is just nuts.
Yeah. Well, you know, I went back and read the two. There have only been two formal statements out of the FBI on the Todashev thing. I went back and read them, which say virtually nothing. And what the first one says was, quote, a violent confrontation. And as we all know, that went from a gun to no gun to a samurai sword on the wall to a pole and a table being overturned. But I don't know if we discussed this with you, Emily, and if we did, my apologies for repeating. Maria Sacchetti did a really nice piece in the Globe about a week or so ago saying that in situations where someone either in custody or being questioned by the FBI is killed, they almost immediately come out with all the details, at least the details as they saw them, that this is the outlier. This is the aberration that we know
we did talk about it weeks later. And
usually
that's exactly what happens. I mean, something is up here. And the fact that, that they were in Todashev's home and they, you know, they hadn't brought him into custody to, you know, to question him. I mean, all of that stuff has not been clarified.
Well, you know, but it sort of it relates to at least my take on this thing we were discussing a minute ago, the Mueller comments about the marathon, whether it's what somebody knew and when they knew it and who they communicated with pre-marathon in terms of the intelligence agencies and law enforcement. We haven't heard much about that. When it comes to Todashev, allegedly one of the two people who killed the three people in Waltham, along with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, we've heard virtually nothing about that. We get headlines and we get leaks, I guess was the point I was trying to make from the two press releases, which said very little, but we almost never have the blanks filled in by our government, by our law enforcement people.
It's I'm trying to get a handle on this. We've been in the news business a long time, and you ran a newsroom at CVB for a long time, WCVB. Is this because there's not enough people to keep pressing this issue? Is this because we don't have the resources we used to? I can't imagine.
Well, as we've said, everything has come through leak. But at some point, it would seem to me the obligation of the federal government to tell us what's going on.
But we in the press have not been exactly vigilant pointing this out day after day after day after day.
There's quite a bit written on this, but it's all coming in dribs and drabs. You know, John Miller from CBS News has been all over it, but you know, no one seems to have an accurate accounting, and the only people who do are the ones who are in that room, and they're not talking.
Do you think it's a coincidence that DeLaurier, who is the head of the FBI the office here, all of a sudden is moving to Detroit to do a pen? You do think it's coincidence?
Yeah, I mean, those guys move around when you think about it. Special agents in charge only hold their stint like 4 or 5 years
in a city.
Before
the Bulger trial's over, you think? You don't find that strange?
He had nothing to do with Bulger. No, I know, but he wasn't here originally.
Well, let's talk about it. I'm obsessed with the Whitey Bulger trial.
Marjorie and I can't get enough.
I'm going down next week to check him out in his dungarees or blue jeans, whatever they call them. And I understand that it wasn't packed on day two. It was packed on day one, not on day two.
Well, it's going to get more packed when
John Matarano,
when Kevin Weeks and John Matarano and some of these key government
Kudos to you for having those interviews with John Conley, Kevin Weeks, and Mrs. Rakes. What's your first name?
Julie Dahmers is her name now. I did that interview 12 years ago.
Yeah. Tell people the point about the baby in that interview.
This is the couple that owned the liquor store Stippo's that Whitey and his gang just took over. They needed a new front. They had been pushed out of Lancaster Street. So Julie's at the store, running the cash register. Whitey goes and Stephen Fleming and Kevin Weeks go to the Rakes' home. He's there. Stephen is home with the two babies. Whitey comes into the kitchen and says, here's the deal. You know, we're going to be partners in this liquor store. And the baby comes over and starts teething on this gun. And basically, Whitey said, well, if you don't go along with this, you're not going to... You're not going to live to see your daughter. Your daughter won't live to see the next day or something like that.
The barrel of the gun in the baby's mouth.
Yeah, teething on the barrel of the gun.
You know, I think the story out of the first week, without a close second, is the fact that we've been promised almost every day by J.W. Carney that Whitey Bulger is chomping at the bit. He cannot wait to testify, to disabuse all of us and the victims' families of all the untruths that have been spread about him. But it seems to me, as somebody who used to be a lawyer when I was a kid, and you don't need to be much of a lawyer to figure this out, that when he didn't tell the jury that they were going to hear from Whitey Bulger, it's because they probably won't hear from Whitey Bulger. And that's
they haven't decided.
But don't you think that's what's going on? Because you don't ever make a promise that you can't honor,
they haven't decided that yet.
Well, can you imagine? He does not have a short fuse. I mean, he does have a short fuse. Can you imagine when the prosecution starts grilling him? He'll explode.
Yeah, he's got nothing to lose, though.
I'm with Emily on this. I mean, what's the downside? Yeah. I mean, you can only get sentenced to life
making
in prison.
Making it worse. He doesn't want to be found guilty of murdering women and babies,
My bet is that Jake Carney is doing everything he can to talk him out of this because he knows he's going to explode under cross-examination.
No, but Emily makes a wonderful point, which is this is not a case that's a close case where you're worried if your client, Sal DeMacy, for example, the former speaker, if he testifies, there's a chance you're going to get acquitted and you don't want him to blow it. There's virtually no chance that Whitey Bulger is going to be acquitted. So why not go for it?
Because I think they're fighting. Whitey wants to do it. Carney says you'd be out of your mind.
Okay, enough of the Bulger thing. I can't wait anymore. Here it is. What you wait for every week for 7 days. Listen up.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense? Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
I have huge interest in Emily's list, and here it is. Take it away, Emily.
All right. So you know how I'm a huge animal fan here, and I've been outraged over that bear that was that innocent little cub that was shot out of the tree.
Oh, right.
Little
tiny
baby bear.
Cub, baby bear.
Yeah, little Smokey.
You have an update on that? Is that what you're
doing? No, but I've got a couple of other really...
What are they?
I've got one that tops that. I don't know if you guys saw this. This is true, and I had to check it out to make sure it was true because I could hardly believe it. So a woman in Ohio finds a pack of feral cats living in her woodpile.
I heard it. Yes. Go ahead. It's unbelievable.
And got five kittens, and they're tracking stuff around and fleas and stuff. She calls animal control. Animal control comes over. Guy says it's a situation. Goes out to his car. She's got two little kids, 3 and 4 years old.
Marjorie hasn't heard
watching
this.
Inside from the kitchen. Goes to his car, gets a gun, and plugs them all in the head.
All the kittens in the litter.
Shoots them all. I know.
And so, that's exactly the reaction. I wish you could see Marjorie's face.
He's a guy from animal control?
Animal control. He's a cop from animal control. So, of course, there was huge outrage, and people wanted him fired and let go. Just like the bear killer here. He was completely vindicated.
Wait, what did they say? That there was no place for the... I didn't hear the end of the
story. He acted properly. Yes. I mean, really.
Do you know, there's a theme emerging here.
Yeah,
the government's going bananas.
But it's also the guys with the guns. I got a solution for this. The least he could have done is taken them all away, euthanized them properly.
Killer.
Yeah.
Wait a second. I'm sorry. I'm with you on this. The theme here is the government going bananas. You're comparing what horrible
actually,
thing happened to these kids in Ohio.
I had the same thought.
Whatever the hell they want. You ask any questions? Too bad. Shut up. Go sit down.
Same thought.
Me too.
You know what's pathetic about this, though? And I am the same place you are in these
kittens. You're a big government guy, Jim.
If there was the poll we saw last week,
enough bureaucracy.
62% of Americans were okay with the NSA surveillance. I would guess that 1% of America, if that, would be okay with this. Would you not agree?
Well, kittens, yeah.
Okay,
exactly.
Fine.
But it is definitely government overreach. Right. Here's a
good
great one.
Good reporting,
Emily. Talk about, animals. This is, in of all places in the world, the country of Colombia has banned the use of any and all wild animals in any circuses of any kind, traveling, permanent. No elephants, no tigers.
Good for them.
I think it's great.
Great.
Oh, you think it is great?
Yeah, we should do the same thing.
Right, it's inhumane.
We should do the same
thing. How about zoos? How do you feel about zoos?
You know, some zoos are okay. A lot of them aren't, but some are.
Providence Zoo.
Roger Williams.
But I don't like them. I don't like them. You see these gigantic animals like rhinoceros and stuff just standing in one place. They're not bred to do that.
Where is this, by the way?
Columbia.
Columbia, the country
in
you said.
Yeah. I think we should do it, too.
You know, I don't know if you're aware. Marjorie hadn't heard of this person, but Marlon Perkins, who used
you
to be host.
You don't know Marlon Perkins?
No, she didn't know who he was. He used to be head of Wild Kingdom.
Yeah, Wild Kingdom.
He died, and there's an opening, Emily, for
Really?
The host of the new Wild Kingdom.
You know why? Maybe moving in.
I never watch these shows.
Why?
I get too upset.
Oh, I watch them all.
Oh, that was a great show.
I watch River Monsters
show.
With Jeremy Wade, my favorite show on TV.
But sometimes you see the animals die. Or
River Monsters, the best show ever.
Predators.
Eden? Eden is the name of a show.
River Monsters.
Oh, I thought you said Eden was the name of a show. Oh, you said that.
Jeremy Wade.
Okay, what next?
All right, so next. This is a rant on CNN.
Go ahead.
For their relentless focus on that little girl who needed the lung transplant. I mean, okay.
In Philadelphia.
An eight-year-old, and she needed to officially qualify for adult lungs. But it's almost as if CNN has changed its focus. You know, it did that relentless coverage on Jodi Arias. And I'm betting that this is all the work of Jeff Zucker, you know, the producer who used to, he was the original Today Show producer, and he's thinking, you know, we've got to distinguish ourselves, we've got to basically dumb down the news.
Yeah.
And, I mean, every time I looked up, it was about this eight-year-old with a, I mean, you know, it's a tragedy, and I'm not big on these stories anyway, where, you know, you the public appeal, and then you end up getting your lung or whatever it is, but, you know, it's one thing for a local TV station, but CNN, I don't know.
They have become tragedy TV,
yeah,
and I'm very distressed because that's the station that I always used to watch, and now I don't know what to watch because they're not only – and it's legitimate when they go out, obviously, these terrible tornadoes and these terrible disasters like that, but they just sort of float from disaster to disaster to disaster now.
Yeah, you know, they picked up on that one because the Jodi Arias thing was over.
And by the way, if people don't know, even though I totally agree with you in terms of the frequency of the coverage, is the kid ultimately – did get the transplant,
yeah,
and they
did.
Say roughly 80% chance she'll live a year, 50% chance she will live.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we're rooting for her. That's
that's not the issue, of course.
I mean, there's a lot of deserving people out there, and to focus on one thing, I don't know, it's troublesome to me.
Okay, what else?
All right, so this one touched my outrage button earlier this week. This is that Milton High School coach who kissed,
libido guy?
Yeah, the libido guy. He kisses a 16-year-old girl. And first of all, he grabs her hand, kisses her, and then he says to her, "Now for the big one." And he pulls her to him and kisses her on the lips. You know, she goes home, tells her mother. Anyway, his defense is that he was taking this drug called Stalevo, S-T-A-L-E-V-O, and for Parkinson's. And it says he claims that his defense is that it's caused decreased self-control and increased libido. Well, my twin sister just happens to work for NIH, so I got her all over this. You know, she works for the National Institutes of Health, and they do all the drug studies and everything. Anyway, there was no description in Stalevo that it causes – there was a thing about libido, but nothing about decreased self-control. The point of it is
– wait, what's the thing about libido?
It had a long list of things. But by the way, libido is sexual desire. You know, but normally libido is with, you know, your partner or
appropriately directed.
This has nothing to do, I mean, to reaching for these defenses, like, you know, you were molesting a 16-year-old. That's what you were doing.
Yeah.
Come on.
That's it for him.
I don't find these that outrageous today at all, actually. I think I'm with Emily on virtually everything.
Really? Well, here's a good one.
What is
it? I love
this.
I saw on your list that you were going to talk about these, the $560,000.
All right. Yes.
That's up next.
You're not going to believe this. Sometimes I feel like I project the news. Anyway, last night I'm watching Scott Pelley. And he did like a 45-second voice. By the way, I love Scott Pelley. I think CBC News is really on the rise. Scott Pelley does this 45-second reader about a condo complex in San Francisco that just sold a parking place for $82,000. And I'm thinking to myself, Scott, what are you talking about? There are places right in my alley that have gone for $250,000. I said, tomorrow I'm going to do some research on that and bring it up. Well, sure enough, the Globe did it for me today. There was at 98 Commonwealth Avenue, the Back Bay alley there, a tandem spot, which is when you're kind of back, you know, one in back of the other. $560,000 for a tandem spot. It's perfectly reasonable.
How much you pay for your spot in the Back Bay?
See, I have a garage that's attached in my building, but I'm sure it's indoors. It's got to be worth $250,000.
Wow.
Easy.
So if you're a little down,
can't sell it separately.
Oh, you can? I was going to say, if you're a little down, you're lucky. You could sell the parking space
and
keep the house.
It makes my condo that more valuable.
So wait, we're going to talk about this in about 60 seconds. What is your reaction? When I read the story,
I understood.
And I have a little history with this, which I'll explain.
I understood.
Yeah, but isn't it really, there is really something wrong with this picture.
It's not
even
right.
If intellectually you say, well, it's understandable. Real estate's really expensive. Yeah. They could be building an apartment. I mean, how nauseating is that? Yes.
People, I mean, the Back Bay parking thing is, I don't know how people do it. They drive around and around and around. I mean, I had to find a place with parking, you know, that had a spot in some form or other. That was just a, you know, anything else was a non-starter.
Do you know this woman, Lisa Blumenthal, who bid the $560,000?
No, I mean, that's crazy because it's obviously worth more than a lot of condos. But I understand her pain. But, you know, well, my point was about Scott Pelley. I was wondering tonight if he's going to say, wait a second, I can trump that.
So what are you doing?
We got an email about this coach from
Libido guy?
Is he from Milton?
Yeah.
Okay, the Milton High School coach's defense is like the Montilio's rum cake defense used by some guy caught driving while under a couple of years ago.
Or the Twinkie defense.
Well, but
so they
wasn't
had to think
Twinkie
of something new.
Defense successful? No. Wasn't it the Dan White thing?
No.
Okay, so what are you doing tonight? It's Beat the Press time.
Well, we are going to be talking about Bulger and, you know, reporting out of there, how a lot of it is coming through tweeting and how some reporters have kind of taken it personally. So, and some of them were personally involved in it because they got called into court. But now a lot of the reporting has sort of become about themselves. So we'll touch on that.
We'll be looking forward to it.
And you can kind of tune in for yourselves.
That's right. Make them tune
tonight at 7 on Beat the Press.
Thank you.
Tonight at 7.
Thank you.
I'll tune in for myself.
Thank you, Emily Rooney.
Those weren't complaints, were they, Marjorie?
No, they were great. They were
great
observations,
insights.
And they were great. Very insightful. I like that very much. Okay, where are we going?
You're wearing that jacket on the air tonight? I love that jacket. I love it. Okay, go ahead.
We're going to continue talking about what Emily did just talk about, is this parking space frenzy. You know, how much are you willing to pay to park your car in the city? $30 maybe all day? $100 in parking tickets? You can park your car somewhere? What about $560,000. $500,000. Okay, it's 2 parking spaces, but that's a little crazy. That's what Lisa Blumenthal paid. I'm going to talk about that up next. Stay tuned.
Our relationship to money and consuming goes back a long way. So too does the question, how much is enough?
The ancient philosophers knew of insatiability. You know, the myth of Midas, the man who wants to turn everything into gold, that's clearly about insatiability.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Back then, maybe a different answer from today. Consumed. Next time on Marketplace, it's from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Innuendo in Natick with the Hunter Douglas Lighter Side of Living event featuring cordless LightRise Blackout Duet Arcatella as well as motorized shades controlled from your smartphone. Innuendo.com. And Skinner, auctioneers and appraisers of antiques and fine art. You might consider auction when downsizing a home or selling a collection. 60 auctions annually, 20 collecting categories, Boston and Marlboro. Online at SkinnerInc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Emily Rooney mentioned it. Marjorie mentioned it. Let me put it in context for you, though. We read this in the Globe this morning. The median price of a single-family home in Massachusetts is just over $300,000, $313,000. Yesterday, as we heard, 2 parking spaces for cars, not humans, sold for nearly twice that, $560,000. I'm going to ask you the same question we asked Emily Rooney. We want to know if you join us. I don't know if Marjorie feels the same way I do. We want to know if you join me in believing that something is really wrong with this picture when 2 parking spaces cost twice as much as the average single family home in Massachusetts.
Well,
the number is 877-301-8970. We're only going to spend a few minutes on this. I just got to get it out of my system. By the way, it is fine. It is perfectly legal. The woman owns the house worth $6 million.
She has a house worth $6 million, which already has 3 parking spaces.
Yeah.
So now she's adding space number 4 and space number 5.
For guests and friends, she said.
For guests and workmen. And you just think to yourself, wow. You know, when you can spend $500,000 on parking spaces for guests who may come like 3 or 4 times a year, or, you know, it's just crazy. I'm jealous.
$560,000. 877-301-8970. We'd love to hear from somebody who says doesn't faze you at all. I mean, it seems to me, remember the occupiers? It seems like ancient history.
Yes.
This is sort of a 1%, 99% kind of thing.
I think so. Yes,
is
I
it
do.
Not, let me say it again. $560,000 for 2 parking spaces. That comes out to $280,000. each for a parking
for
space.
For parking space.
In the Back Bay.
And is the writer in the Globe, I forget her name, that wrote the piece, it was very funny. She said, you know, they're kind of shabby.
Katie Johnson.
Katie Johnson, thank you very much. They're kind of shabby parking spaces. It's just an unkept bit of asphalt here. But they are right next to each other. And people were out there in the rain, and the bidding went up to six figures within minutes of opening. And the guy, it's incredible, the guy that lost the spaces, yeah. The IRS came after because he owned $600,000 in back taxes. He could have paid all his back taxes.
Just selling
had
the
he
two
sold
parking
the parking spaces
right.
himself. Instead, the IRS gets in there, and he gets nothing.
I'm so glad you brought up the point you brought. When you look at the photograph in the newspaper, the asphalt is broken.
Very shabby.
There are crummy-looking air conditioners sticking
exactly.
out the back of the windows of the houses on
Commonwealth
Avenue.
$500,000, couldn't they have painted the lines on the space a little bit so you could see when you drive into your parking space when you're visiting overnight? Oh, my God.
You know, I don't know how I'd do it. If I were running for mayor of Boston, which luckily I'm not, particularly since I don't live in Boston, I think I'd run on this. I don't know exactly what my platform would be, but something is just really, it just doesn't feel quite right, apparently, to both me and Marjorie. Bless you, Marjorie. Let's go to Tim in West Newbury. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Tim.
Good afternoon, guys, and thanks for taking
pleasure.
So, I've been missing you a lot lately because I've been having to work.
Hate that. Don't you hate that?
Well, BC Alternative. Yeah.
It would take me about 10 years to make the money to buy one of those parking spots.
I know.
In any event, and it's been raining out a lot, and I work outside, and I've had to make hay while the sun shines, so to speak. But anyways, what I want to say is that is the most in-your-face example of what's wrong with of our problem of income inequality in this country.
It is. It is, and the occupiers have just disappeared.
Something is wrong when a guy runs a large corporation and makes 350 times the average wage of the average worker in the corporation, especially looking back and seeing that 30, 40 years ago, it was like he made 100 times and was quite satisfied.
Well, actually, it was closer to 40 times, but your point is very well made, Tim. The inequality is out of control. Tim, thank you for the call. You know, one possibility is to restore a little bit of equity here. Maybe some of the occupiers could just live in one of the parking spaces.
Exactly.
I mean, you got to do something. When the guests
right.
aren't there and the workmen aren't there.
Or take in some homeless people. You know, they could put up a little tent there. And when she has guests, they could move out temporarily and move back when the guests leave. But, you know, it's interesting. She was very upfront about it.
She shouldn't be. We're not trashing Lisa Blumenthal.
No.
She's entitled to do it. She says she needs the spaces for workmen and friends and what guests and that sort of thing.
We have no idea. This woman may be hugely charitable and she may give tons mm-hmm. and tons and tons of money to charity and she may be doing her part and all that kind of thing. It just sort of says something that you could actually spend that much money on parking spaces. Let's go to Travis from Revere. Are they going for that kind of money up in Revere, Travis?
That's kind of what I'm calling to talk about, guys.
What's that?
You know, I'm really glad you brought up everybody remember Occupy, because this really drives the whole 99.1% thing home, especially for someone like me. I'm about $140,000 in student debt, and it's going to take me close to a decade to deal with that. And, you know, I'm employed, luckily enough, but I'm an engineer, and I live in my mom's basement just so we can, you know, deal with the minimums on these loan payments every month. And to think that someone can take almost five times the sum of money it would take to utterly change my life forever for parking spaces, for guests and friends, oh, good for you. Good for you.
Travis, we wish you soon out of your mom's basement. Thank you so much for the for the call. It really is extreme. You know, I have to say, in the spirit of full disclosure, which, you know,
have
is
you
not
bought
the
some
spirit.
Parking spaces?
No, I have two very close friends who uh-huh. shall remain unnamed, who are very wealthy, who are two of the humblest, most decent, most charitable people I've ever met. This is totally coincidental. I have dinner with them maybe twice a year just to talk
really?
Politics, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Who
so,
pays?
We go back and forth, actually. So about 2 years ago, this is a true story. I don't subscribe to the Enquirer, you know, the magazine, but I occasionally read it when I'm in line at the supermarket, like a lot of people do. So the front page of the Enquirer that particular day or week,
the National Enquirer?
National Enquirer, is a story of the most expensive parking space in America. And this is a totally true story. I know it sounds like it's impossible to believe, but it is not. And it says, I don't know what the price was, something like the most expensive space went for $200,000 in Boston. And I'm looking at this, and I'm having the exact same reaction we're having on the 560. So I'm having dinner with this couple, and we're just talking. I said, by the way, did you see the story about the parking space in Boston for $200,000. And there's silence across the table. And I said, how much would you like to know who bought this?
Oh, no.
And you know the end of the story. They looked at each other, and the husband said, it was us. And by the way, they did it for, I'm not going to get into all the details. They did it for a really good reason, which I will not share. But they're different worlds. Now, they are, I'm hoping this Lisa Blumenthal, who I tried to check out but was unable to before the show, as you say, is a charitable, generous kind of soul, which will sort of mute the, I guess, the impact of waking up to read that someone spent more than $500,000 for two parking spaces. Let's squeeze one more in quickly. John, you're in Melrose. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, John.
Hello. I'm just wondering if these people are having that parking space surveyed. Because when I bought my house here, we had it surveyed, even though the bank theoretically does survey your property.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we found out that we were paying taxes on 4 feet in front of our house, onto which is a sidewalk.
Hmm. I have no idea if they had it surveyed or not,
exactly,
but I'm
John,
not sure how it relates.
Yeah,
exactly.
What's your point there? Quickly, John, if you would. What are you saying?
Do they actually own the property that they think they own? Because surveying, when is the last time the Back Bay was actually surveyed?
I have to say I do not know.
I don't know. Someone's owned the spaces for a long time. The IRS came in and took them as part of their settlement. The guy owed back taxes. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I don't know. I would think you'd want to
Thank
check
you,
that out, though, before you spend $500,000 on parking spaces, but we do not know. Anyway, up next, it is our Friday news quiz. It's a Boston Public Radio bake-off. Dunkin' Donuts executive chef is going to face off with the pastry chef, who also owns Flower Bakeries and the restaurant Myers & Chang. Our bake-off news quiz is up next. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH.
Forging a new path in the world of faith can be difficult, especially for a woman looking for a place in roles traditionally held by men. But that's what Ruth Belinsky Friedman is doing, along with a handful of others. We'll hear how she's mixing innovation and tradition, becoming a faith leader in Orthodox Judaism. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Before Midnight, starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as Jesse and Celine, a couple vacationing in Greece who continue exploring their relationship after their romantic meeting 18 years ago. Now playing. And the 5th Annual Exconomy Summit on Innovation, Technology, and Entrepreneurship on June 19th, featuring a keynote talk from Tom Leighton, CEO of Akamai, and the opportunity to learn from and network with innovation leaders. Excite2013.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. It's time for our Friday news quiz. And Marjorie and I were just saying how hungry we were. How fortunate are we? We're joined by two contestants. In one corner is pastry chef Joanne Chang. She owns the Great Flower Bakeries with her husband. She also owns a great restaurant that I love, Chinese restaurant Myers & Chang. Her new cookbook is Flower 2, as in T-O-O, Indispensable Recipes by Joanne Chang. Joanne Chang, it's great to meet you.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
What'd you bring, by the way?
We brought an assortment of cookies.
Oh, fantastic.
We have double chocolate, chunky Lola, raspberry crumb bars, oatmeal raisin, everything.
I think I can finish those. We have a 22-minute quiz. I think I can do that. I think I can do that.
And
Stan Frankenthaler. He's the chef. He was the chef and owner of Blue Room and Salamander. He's now Dunkin' Brand's first executive chef, which means he can thank you for the Dunkin' Donuts glazed donut breakfast sandwich. Welcome, Stan. And you brought some goodies as well.
I did. We Ooh. Brought donuts, of course.
But Marjorie, I want you to know, beat you to the punch. Marjorie went out today and purchased
right
what she
street.
Thought were your newest donut creations. What were the flavors again?
I think they're lime and lemonade, correct?
Is that correct?
It's, yes, key lime pie.
Yes.
And lemonade.
Lemonade. We
summer,
have them right there.
Summer donuts.
I think we can finish those up too, Stan. What was the transition
I think so.
For you?
I'd like to swap. I'd like to have the box of cookies
yeah,
over here and
I'll
the donuts over to Joanne.
Well, I think we can all eat.
I want to know before we start this, though, because you both made fascinating transitions. I'm going to start with you, Joanne. You were a mathematics and economics major at Harvard, and then you went into the consulting business, and then you threw it all away. So what
threw
happened?
It all away?
Well,
what are you doing now, Joanne?
You sound like my mom.
If I was your mother, that's what I would say. I mean, it turned out well. well, but that was pretty dramatic. So what, how'd you get from A to B?
Well, I think, you know, at the time, it does sound dramatic now, but at the time, I was simply taking a year off. I had worked for a couple of years as a management consultant, and I didn't want to go to business school, which was kind of the natural next step. And I thought, I've always loved to cook. I've loved to eat. I love being in the kitchen. I'm going to see if I can get a job in a professional restaurant. So I took a year off, and that's what I did.
Okay.
And then I fell in love with it. And then I just kept working in restaurants and bakeries and restaurants and bakeries until I opened Flower. So it wasn't quite as dramatic as it seems now, because at the time it was just a small diversion, and then I would eventually get back into business.
Can you do me a favor while you're talking to Marjorie? Can you pass that box in my
and
direction?
Stan,
thank you, Joanne.
You went from, as Jim said, you know, kind of high-end, la-di-da. Not that this, I mean, I'm a big Dunkin' Donuts fan, but you don't think of it as, you know, five-star restaurant where you're doing the whole soup to nuts kind of food. So how'd that happen that you went from the whole nine yards of a restaurant meal from beginning to end to donuts?
Well, I think a few things. I mean, you know, great opportunity. As you said, it's the first time that Dunkin' Brands went out to seek an executive chef to really drive the menu. And, you know, at that time, about 8 or 9 years ago, it was really sort of a change of leadership at the brand. And since then, we've had great support to grow the menu and grow both Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin-Robbins through the creation of our new menu items and to be completely unique and differentiated in the marketplace, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about the things that we offer, we have this great opportunity to create wonderful products. We cook seasonally, right? We do cool things like we customize everything for you. You can have your coffee any way you want.
Yes, you can.
We have
and
great
Turbo
variety.
Which I love.
Yeah. And
can I stop you right there, please? One thing I know is chicken salad. And that chicken salad wrap thing
good.
That you have, I don't even know what it's called. It's relatively new, about
it
six
is.
Months ago.
Yes.
Is fabulous. What is that
thank
deal?
You. What, sorry?
What is that thing? It's a...
Well, I kind of call it like a club wrap. It's so it's a tortilla with real aged white cheddar cheese and cherry wood smoked bacon.
Where
we don't
they?
Tell you that
you
it has the bacon.
You?
I could get those. There's, I'm sure there's a Dunkin' within like 100 feet of here or something, right? Like no more than 500 feet is the
and
rule.
And Joanne, what is this unbelievable thing that I am devouring? What is this baby right
those
here?
Those are raspberry crumb bars.
Oh, my God.
Shortbread, raspberry jam, strudel.
Do you eat your own? I mean,
I do all day long.
Is that really true?
Yeah.
How do you do? And you're fit, and what's that about?
Well, we have four locations plus the restaurant, and I go to as many of them as I can each day by bike. And so I'm spending all my time on bike, running around. So that helps. Mm. And honestly, when I'm eating, I'm tasting. So I don't know the last time I sat down and had like a full lunch.
Yeah.
But I go to each location and I take a bite here and there. And
I haven't had a full lunch for like 20 minutes. So I can relate to that. Why don't we get started? Why don't we do a girl-to-girl, boy-to-boy
okay.
thing? Marjorie, you can start with Joanne
Chang. Ready, Joanne?
Yes.
President Obama was in Boston this week. Whom is he talking about in this clip?
I need folks in the United States Senate who every day are waking up thinking about the people who sent them there and trying to figure out how do I make sure that they are getting a brighter future. That's who a is.
Oh.
I need a
I'm going to guess.
Oh, you didn't hear that?
I didn't. Oh. But I know what he was in town for.
What was he here for?
To eat hamburgers at Charlie's. Right?
That's actually the answer to the bonus question.
That is where he ended up. Was it Charlie's
Charlie's Kitchen,
shop?
Which is in the
South
End.
Sandwich Fabulous.
Yeah,
that's
a great,
great
place. Oh, that wasn't fair. You couldn't hear the question.
Well, she got to the bonus question as well. So she does
okay.
fine.
All right.
Now, I have to ask you, were you listening to the show a few minutes ago, Stan?
While we were talking.
Okay, well, we'll give it a shot. This is, we talked about this, but you may have missed it.
Jim, you have to give the answer. It was Ed Markey.
Oh, I'm sorry. But yeah, but the hard question was the cheeseburger at Charlie's, and she got that perfectly. Okay, what was auctioned off yesterday in the Back Bay for an unheard-of price?
Here we'll be here tomorrow. 410, look for 420. 550, look for 560. 560, sold! 560, the bid of number 9.
Okay, so what was auctioned off in the Back Bay for a record price yesterday? I'm glad you missed that part of the show. Do you have any idea?
Was it the Superman comic thing? I heard... No, Joanne.
Joanne's not allowed to give you hints. This is a competition.
This is
radio. It's not a love fest. It's okay, Stan.
No, recently I heard that... The one of the original comics that Superman appeared on was found and auctioned off, but I don't know.
That's
that.
A great
I
answer.
I don't think that was in Boston.
That would be the wrong answer. Do you know the right answer, Joanne Chang? You can steal the points.
The parking space.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, the tandem parking space we were talking about.
That's right. I had no idea what a tandem parking space was.
Now, you're
was.
Both doing quite well professionally, but when you hear the two parking spaces are going for $560,000, what's your immediate reaction, Stan, please?
Thank God I'm never going to bid on that.
Yeah. I'm in the wrong business.
You are, you man.
Yeah, that was just, I was so jealous I could hardly stand it. Okay, this is going to be for you, Joanne. Who is this newly transplanted New Englander?
It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to working hard every single day and getting a lot better and learning under some great people. So that's all I got, but thank y'all so much and God bless.
You know that is? It was talking.
Tim.
Don't tell her.
Tim.
Can I say how great it is? There's actually somebody who lives in Boston who does not know this guy's last name.
I know it's a verb at this point.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But you only got half the points. I'm sorry.
She knows who he is.
Can we still do the hail?
She knows who he is. You know who he is.
To Tebow.
That's right. That's right.
Close enough. Tebow. It's close enough.
The new New England Patriots that does the Tebowing in the end zone. But he won't be able to do it much in Boston because I don't think he's going to get in the game that often. That's my prediction.
How does it feel to be the only person in greater Boston who could not have the word Tebow spill off their tongue? Is that a badge of honor for you, Joanne Chang?
I don't follow sports that
Neither
much.
Neither do I.
Yeah.
I really
don't.
There you go.
Are you a sports guy, Stan?
Yeah.
How do you feel about the Tim Tebow coming to town?
I think it's great, actually. You know, I think for his opportunity and the way that the Patriots like to use players, it could be a good fit.
You want a little advice from me? You don't need business advice. I'll give it to you anyway. Imagine Tim Tebow. What's the new donut? Lemonade? What is it? Key lime?
Yeah.
With a key lime donut in his mouth.
Yeah,
how
I like
great
it.
Would that be?
I
Where's
like
the
it.
Key lime donut?
I'm imagining Tim Tebow actually scoring points for the Patriots.
You think so?
Yeah, I think Belichick. I mean, I think, Tebow, Belichick, Brady. I mean, I really do. I think if there's an opportunity for Tebow, it could be really with Belichick and with this team, it could be great.
Should I be embarrassed? There are four people in this room. The only person who's eating is me.
No,
is this the new?
All.
What is this thing?
You invited us all here so you could have that chance.
What
right?
is this thing?
That's
please.
The lemonade donut. So it's a shell donut with vanilla frosting, a white chocolate lemonade brittle. And a lemon filling.
So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask you the next question. While you're listening to the sound, I will be eating this donut. Okay?
And I'll have the key lime.
And I'm going to try to distract
right. you. Okay, here we go. We're going to play you a news clip from just yesterday, Stan Frankenthaler. Then we'll ask you about it. Please listen.
Menino will send the best of Boston's local foods, including seafood. He'll hand over Boston's website to Rahm Emanuel for a day to post in promotional videos touting Chicago. He'll send tickets to the Huntington Theater Company to Theo Epstein's Hot Stove Cool Music concert in Boston. And also, he will plant a tree in a Chicago schoolyard as well.
Okay, so here's the, it was Mike Nikitas from NECN, my station. What has to happen, Stan, in order to force Mayor Menino to do all of the things that he is talking about?
Well, that would be if, and only possibly if, the Blackhawks could beat the Bruins.
That would be exactly correct. That is right. And we're about to have game two, I think, tomorrow night. Now, Marjorie, you give us the verdict first.
I just have the key lime, and I have to say it is delicious. It's got the frosting on the top. A little, what is that? A little crumbles?
Graham cracker.
Graham cracker
like
top.
The graham cracker crust.
Okay,
yeah.
The graham cracker crust and the key lime in the middle. So it's sort of like a jelly donut, but it's got key lime in the middle, which is delicious. And I'm about to try the crumbled raspberry tart.
But not until you ask Joanne Chang another question. Why don't you ask the next question?
I'm sorry. I look like I'm talking with food in my mouth.
Because you are, actually. Yes,
I sort of am. Okay.
Why?
We're on Joanne Chang. Okay, here we go. Here's The Daily Show's John Oliver describing this week's big NSA privacy dust-up. Did I goof
it up? Do we not have sound on that one?
Oh, I may have done the wrong question.
You skipped a question.
I'm sorry.
Go back up.
This is actor.
Actor.
Okay, I'm sorry, you guys. Actor Peter Mayhew was detained by TSA at the Denver airport after the Denver Comic-Con security stopped him due to a lightsaber cane he was carrying. Here's Stephen Colbert's reaction.
Peter Mayhew was detained. Now, you may say this was an unnecessary overreach, but I, for one, am relieved the TSA has finally joined the Empire in their fight against the Rebel Alliance. Who we all know will stop at nothing to overthrow a duly elected Emperor Palpatine.
Okay, here's the question, Joanne. What furry character did Peter Mayhew play when he was stopped at the airport?
Well, this is a tough question.
It is a tough one. You have to be a Star Wars fan.
Oh, furry character Chewbacca.
Whoa.
Very good. Very, very good. That was wonderful. That was a hard
one. She may not know football, but this woman knows.
Star Wars was my first date in third grade.
Is that really true?
Yeah.
Who'd you go with?
Jason. I don't remember his last
Where's
name.
Where's Jason now? Do we have Andrew?
No idea. And my parents sat behind us. I mean, we were eight.
How cute is that? Oh, that's great. Did you hold hands?
I don't know. We might have brushed hands next to each other and got really embarrassed.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, here's the next question for you, Stan Frankenthaler. He is the Dunkin' Brand's first executive chef. I should say, am I asking the Jay Leno question? I think I am. Am I not? Yes, I am. Here's Jay Leno. What new film is Jay Leno speaking about? Listen.
The new movie opens on Friday. We had Russell Crowe on the other night. He plays father, and it's a great story. When dad realizes that his son is gifted with X-ray vision and super hearing, he puts him in a rocket and send him towards Earth, because he knows with those powers, he can get a job with the Obama administration. So we can see it's a fascinating story.
Okay, so what movie is he speaking about, Stan Frankenthaler, please? Superpowers. I'll give you a little hint.
Yeah, yeah.
You actually may have been speaking about this at some point in the relatively recent past, this particular character. In fact, as recently as about 10 minutes ago.
Superman.
That would be Superman. That is exactly correct. Now, you know what the lightning round is, you two? Good. A lightning round is when we move quickly through these questions. Since both of you are bakers, we're going to ask you each questions about the 1989 hit, which Marjorie and I love, the fabulous Baker Boys. You ever see the movie? That's too bad. Okay, the first question, Marjorie, is for Joanne Chang.
By the way, the raspberry tart was absolutely delicious.
Thank you.
Okay, from the trailer for the Fabulous Baker Boys, starring Jeff and Beau Bridges, here we go.
I've been thinking maybe we should make some changes. I've been thinking maybe we should take on a singer.
Thirty-seven girls and not one who can carry a tune.
Name?
Susie Diamond.
You have any previous experience?
For the last couple of years, I've been on call for the AAA escort service.
What would you like to share with us today, Miss Diamond?
And we should say, by the way, for not just two of you, for those who haven't seen it, the Baker Brothers, or boys, are played by the real-life Jeff and Beau Bridges. It's a great movie. They're basically failing, and they decide they need a front, they need a singer. So they get this woman who's a, quote, escort. Her name is Susie Diamond in the film, played brilliantly, I think, by Michelle Pfeiffer, one of her great roles ever. So that's the brief synopsis of the film. What's the first question,
Margaret? So we're going to ask you a multiple-choice question. Only one of these options is true. Madonna was originally approached to play the songs with Susie Diamond. She ultimately turned down the role because, and these are your four multiple-choice possible answers. Actually, there's only three. A, Hollywood execs refused to include her character Susie Diamond in the movie's title. That's A. B, she didn't want to be typecast as a singer. And C, she thought the plot was too mushy.
I'm going to guess A. Oh, man.
So you can steal this question, Stan.
Chance.
How about it?
C.
C is correct. Madonna thought the plot too mushy.
And I want you to know it is really getting tight. The score is getting tight.
I didn't think it was a mushy movie. I thought it was pretty sexy.
And I thought she would be okay with mushy. Like she's kind
maybe
of like
maybe she didn't
into
want the connection to
stuff.
The past occupation or something.
Maybe that's right. Do we know anything about her being an escort before she became a singer?
No. Michelle Pfeiffer is brilliant. She is a fabulous actress.
Oh, she's
I'm
gorgeous.
I'm glad she got the role.
Draped across the piano. I mean, really, it was wonderful.
Marjorie, why don't you continue with the questions? Go ahead.
Okay. Which among these three options is not true about the Fabulous Baker Brothers? Here we go. A, while filming a fight scene, Jeff Bridges broke Beau Bridges' hand, sending him to the hospital. B, after shooting the Fabulous Baker Boys, Jeff Bridges released an album of piano ballads called Bridges. Or C, there was a short-lived TV show called Baker Boys about bakers in a small fictional village in South Wales. Okay, which of these options is not true?
I'm going to have to go for C.
Ooh. Wow, I was going to guess C.
Okay.
Now you have a chance to guess something else, Joanne.
B.
That is correct.
You are correct. You are correct. That's right.
Okay,
we have
my turn.
Not released this horrible ballad of albums, an album of ballads.
Now, Joanne, this is for you. The Fabulous Baker Boys. You're both going to go see it now, I hope. Are you not?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. The Fabulous Baker Boys received glowing reviews from critics. In their film review, how did Time magazine describe Michelle Pfeiffer? A, her cat-like tread keeps us wondering if she'll purr or pounce. B, Pfeiffer's a real glamour puss. She'll never have to cash in those nine lives to remain one of Hollywood's brightest stars. Or C, Michelle Pfeiffer is a cat with at least nine dimensions, ever a flicker in her eyes. Which one is how Time described her performance in The Fabulous Baker Boys?
A.
That would be wrong, Joanne Chang. Now, Stan, you can steal another one. I think you can basically tie this baby up here. Go ahead. What do you got?
All right, I got C.
That is exactly correct.
Do we have time for last question?
Last Pfeiffer question. Fan. And we want you to... Okay. Are you a big Michelle Pfeiffer fan?
Oh, yeah.
If you get this one right, you actually end in a dead heat, which would really be wonderful. Go ahead,
okay,
Marjorie.
Ask the question. One more multiple choice, A, B, C. What pet created an emergency for the Baker Boys? A, Mr. Bud, the calico cat who had an impacted hairball. B, Eddie, the black lab who required oral surgery. Or C, Junior, the capuchin monkey who went missing.
Is it mine?
See you, Stan. Yes.
I'm going with A.
Sorry.
So sad when that plays, isn't it?
Okay.
Joanne,
the monkey
is for all the
or the black lab?
The monkey.
Oh. Wait, I'm going to guess. I will guess it's the black lab. Is that correct?
That would be correct, Jim.
So I win.
Jim.
Thank you very much. So, Joanne Chang, tell us in a minute, what's in the future of Flower or Myers? How many? Are there four Flowers now?
We have four Flowers.
So what's the future look like for you guys?
Well, I just released the second book, so I'm actively out there on book tour. And then I am...
Flower 2, Indispensable Recipes by Joanne Chang.
Yes.
Okay.
And then I'm working on a third book. Hopefully it'll be out in a couple of years, a low-sugar baking book.
Whoa.
Yeah. Totally Excellent. Different direction.
Why do you have how do you have time to do all this stuff? I'm serious. How do you have time to do the balance everything you're doing?
You know, I have a really great team, and so I delegate. I delegate a lot of things. I run around to every location, say hi, I eat a lot of things, and then I test recipes and then run off to another location.
Let me just ask you one more really, really important question I think everybody wants to know, at least I want to know. You're not going to take the remaining cookies with you. Is that correct? Okay,
not
fine.
Not a chance.
So, Stan, what's in the future at the Dunkin' Donuts brand? What's in the future for you? And by the way, your lead time, one of the interesting things, when you do what you do, I mean, Joanne Chang, if she comes up with something, I assume relatively quickly, it ends up in one of her places. You don't have quite the same luxury. So what's down the line on the Dunkin' front?
Well, I think... you know, more growth in the areas that you've seen, right? More of the afternoon sandwiches. We've been doing a lot with our frozen beverages. I think both of those areas will grow. And, of course, coffee and breakfast. Our turkey sausage breakfast sandwich has...
Who had it a couple
addition.
Of days? Marjorie, who brought that in a
yeah,
couple
you
of
brought
days
it in
ago?
A couple
Thank
days
you
ago.
Very
Didn't
much.
I see a Father's Day special cook donut today?
Yeah, we celebrate. Yeah. I mean, the thing that's great about, you know, both Baskin-Robbins and Dunkin' Donuts is, you know, it's a chance to celebrate kind of daily and current events.
Yeah.
And seasonally, we do great pumpkin, we do great apple, we do great blueberries. So
yeah, it's black and white, I think, wasn't it? It's yeah. like fall. It was
yeah.
kind of cool.
The
yeah.
only
very masculine looking donut.
I shouldn't criticize Dunkin' Donuts while you're kind enough to be here. The one criticism I think everybody would share
okay,
is that
Jim.
National Donut Day is only one day a year. That is a real.
You know, I feel that
that's
way
a
too.
Real problem. Stan Frankenthaler, who's the Dunkin' brand's first executive chef. Stan, it was a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much. Joanne Chang, huge fan. Obviously, she's the woman behind Flower and with her husband, Myers and Chang. Fabulous restaurants. Great to meet you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank
and thank
you.
All of you guys. We've been joined. I told you who we've been joined by. Now, the folks who work on Boston Public Radio are these. Edgar B. Herrick III, Chelsea Mers, John Parker, Will Roselip, and Abby Ruzica. They are all fabulous. None of this would happen without them. You can follow us on Twitter till we come back on Monday at BOS Public Radio. Or me at Jim Browdy, or Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. You can find us on the web all the time at wgbhnews.org/BPR. On Monday on our political panel, we're going to preview the final debate in the critical U.S. Senate race. Mm-hmm. That is Tuesday night right here at WGBH, I should say. And we'll also be joined by Reverend Eugene Rivers, who, if you read today's Boston Herald, is on page one
yes.
with a message to fathers on this Sunday, Father's Day. Read it before Monday. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
Thanks. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you Monday at noon.